the day the earth stood still, but he told us where we stand. And Flash Gordon was there in silver underwear. Claude Rains was the invisible man. Then something went wrong for Fay Wray and King Kong. They got caught in a celluloid jam. Then at a deadly pace, it came from outer space. And this is how the message ran.
All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum.
And Matt Levine.
And we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts are welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. Hey, Matt. Good to see you.
Hey, Vincent. Good to see you as well. How are you doing?
I'm good. I got a lot of spinning plates right now, including being a sports fan, Minnesota Twins, Twins territory. Fighting for our playoff lives as we speak, but you know, you're a sports fan, you know the ups and downs and the heartbreak and joy of it all.
Absolutely, yeah. In the past, I have not been a huge baseball fan, but I have to admit this year I got a lot more into it. So I'm originally from Wisconsin, so I was rooting on the Brewers, and then they lost almost as quickly as possible.
Yeah,
in the playoffs. So that was a bummer, but yeah, I'm rooting on the Twins too. So we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. Maybe our Day of the Triffids talk can be just the lucky charm they need.
Yeah, that would be unexpected. But hey, I would welcome it for sure.
You know, it's funny, though, folks listening to this, we're talking in the past a little bit. Matt and I are recording on Thursday, the 11th of October. And this is, if you're listening to it on the weekend, this episode drops, it'll be The Twins may very well not even be in the playoffs at this point.
So we'll be either reveling and celebrating when this episode goes out, or just wallowing in our despair. One of the two.
Yeah.
Maybe not quite that serious.
Well, but maybe it's, it reminds me of Day of the Triffids. Maybe we'll just be in a blind stupor, walking around the nuclear, the post-apocalyptic wasteland.
Trying to kidnap a young girl that can see just to lead us on the correct path, that's going to be us.
Yeah. All right. Enough sports talk. Let's get to our monsters. So thank you all, friends, for hanging out. Special thanks to our patrons, Jason, Kelly, Peggy, and our anonymous donor. Please rate and review wherever you listen, whoever you are. You can also share this podcast with a friend. Let's grow the monster family, and send us listener comments, your reviews, your thoughts and feedback at campkaiju@gmail.com, on our Instagram, or on our website. Matt, what is that website for folks to check out?
That website is campkaijumoviereviews.com. And in addition to all of the episodes of the podcast, we'll also have news updates. We'll probably get into some of those news updates in just a moment here. But then we also have reviews of some movies that we don't talk about in the podcast.
We'll get into our plot synopsis here. Just want to shout out Twin Cities Horror Fest. You can catch my play. I wrote and I'm producing it, called The Hand That Washed Ashore. It opens Friday, October 20th at 6 p.m. There's a link in the bio, but check out all the available dates. It runs for a whole week, 5 performances throughout that week. So yeah, should be some things to check out there. Matt, what is coming up, and then what's your personal history with Day of the Triffids?
So on our next episode of Camp Kaiju, we'll be talking about another maybe so bad it's good movie. I don't want to throw around that phrase too lightly, but we're going to be talking about The Toxic Avenger, a classic in its own way, sort of splatterfest, gory, grade Z shocker from 1984, which is the year that I was born. I feel like that movie... never mind. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. But if you've seen The Toxic Avenger, then you know how kind of like sleazy and gross, but also kind of interesting and funny it is. So yeah, we'll have some things to talk about there. As far as what's coming up after that, I do not remember. Sorry.
That's okay. We're playing it fast and loose here at Camp Kaiju right now. So after The Toxic Avenger, we're going to drop an episode from our vault. It's kind of a weird weekend where it's technically the last weekend of October. And just the way our recording schedule lined up, Matt, you and I could squeeze something in. But again, it's the opening of The Hand That Washed Ashore. There's Halloween parties. There's all sorts of things going on. So I thought I'd give us a break. Just release a vintage episode when we talked about White Zombie with Bela Lugosi.
Nice. You know, I feel kind of bad because I gave that a bad review when we talked about it, but I feel like if I watched it again, I would be a little more lenient towards it this time. So for anybody listening, if you listen to that White Zombie episode and my criticisms in it, take them with a grain of salt. I might take some of them back now.
Yeah, after watching some of these other, you know, camp classics, so bad they're good movies, I'm like, you know what? White Zombie isn't a train wreck.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There's some competent things about it. You know, you brought up sports before, and I also just want to say that the NBA season starts in late October. So I'm very, I won't push back against your decision to release an episode from the vaults, because I'll be watching a lot of basketball around that time.
That's great. That's great. Great, great. All right. Then in November, we'll have maybe a couple other episodes, maybe some Gamera. But stay tuned. We'll keep you updated on that, because then I'm having a baby born.
Yeah.
We're going to have to retool a few things on Camp Kaiju.
Well, congratulations again on that to you and Ellen. That's just such great news. So that's awesome. Best news of 2023.
I think so. Not too shabby.
Yeah.
Okay. Day of the Triffids. Why'd you bring this one to the pod? What's your history with it?
I didn't really know too much about it. I read that, we've had some so bad it's good movies on podcasts recently. Like we talked about Troll 2 and Plan 9 from Outer Space. And I read that the Day of the Triffids, the 1962 version, which is what we're going to be talking about, is one of those so bad it's good movies from what I've read. I'm always fascinated by killer plant movies because it's like impossible to make them scary. I've seen Little Shop of Horrors a long time ago, which maybe is more of like a horror comedy. There's The Happening, the M. Night Shyamalan movie. There's like no way to make plants scary. I've never seen it and it seems impossible. Mm. So, you know, I wanted to bring this movie to the podcast to first of all answer the question, how bad is it actually? According to its reputation. And secondly, are plants scary in this movie? Mm-hmm. Stay tuned for the answer. I won't give it away right now.
Ooh, the anticipation. The anticipation. That doesn't make sense.
Oh, but on that note, I mean, like Troll 2 also has killer plants. So this is part of like our plantsploitation double feature a little bit.
I think the plants in Troll 2 are kind of scary.
They're gross. Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, they're very gory. I think the vines in Evil Dead are effectively scary.
That is true. Oh, you know, there is like an ominous tree in the movie The Guardian by William Friedkin that I saw recently. So yeah, I mean, like if you broaden it out to like vines and trees, there's some scary ones, but plants in and of themselves, I still believe they are not scary.
Right. And a whole feature film around plants might not be as scary as just like a cameo appearance by one particular plant.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah. There it is.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Sorry, what's your history with this movie?
I'd never heard of it until you brought it to my attention earlier this year. likewise, I've seen those other Killer Plant movies. So I was really into watching this one because it is a subgenre of the monster, you know, monster realm of films, of horror films. So it's interesting. I watched a print on Tubi. And the quality was very bad.
Yeah, I watched a version on Redbox. I had never watched anything on the streaming platform Redbox before, and it was also terrible. And then, like, when I tried to go back and, like, rewatch some scenes to do a little more research or whatever, I watched a version on YouTube and a version on the Internet Archive, both of which were so much better than what I watched on Redbox. So there are a couple, like, decent versions out there. And they're in the free formats, not the ones that you have to, like, you know, sign up for a streaming service, which is weird.
Interesting. I did not get around to watching a cleaner print of the film, unfortunately. And I would like to, because I will say off the bat that the poor quality of the version I watched really dragged on my viewing experience. When I watch movies that are probably already a little, maybe slow, a little wonky, and then the quality of the print is very poor, it's a tough watch for me. Do you have that too?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel the same way for sure. Yeah, it's unfortunate. Like, this is one of those movies that was in the public domain for a while, meaning that, like, nobody owned the rights to it. So, you know, anybody could, like, release their own terrible looking DVD copy of it. And I think that's why there are so many poor versions of it floating around on the internet right now. And I don't think it's ever, like, been, like, even the decent ones that I watched on YouTube and the Internet Archive, you know, it's not like they're, like, remastered and cleaned up or anything like that. It's sort of just like, oh, I can actually tell what's going on, which is better than the original version I saw.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, like, even when I watched a slightly better version, I was like, oh, this still doesn't look very good. And I had most of the same criticisms, but I'm sure my initial experience still kind of impacted that a little bit.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. And it's interesting that it hasn't been, like, properly remastered and released on Blu-ray or whatever, just because it's a cult classic, at least. Like, people talk about this movie. It's based on a well-known science fiction story. Yeah, it's like fallen through the cracks of time a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. It's too bad. I mean, like, there is an audience out there for it, like you said. It probably doesn't get as much, like, there are just, like super fans of, like, Ed Wood. Like, I understand why, like, there are, like, better looking versions of his movies, for, like, a few of them anyway. And, like, I'm thinking of older British horror movies like Village of the Damned and stuff like that, which is, like, a genuinely great movie in my opinion. So yeah, like, a movie like this that's, like, campy and fun but maybe not a masterpiece probably does fall through the cracks a little bit, like you said.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's read the synopsis quick and then we can get to some of the cast and crew, production history, and we got a couple of pretty neat Minya's mailbox letters to answer. So cool. Yeah, should be a good episode.
Yeah, awesome. I can't wait.
All right, here we go. So the movie opens with a meteor shower and it blinds most people in the world. Anyone who looks at this meteor shower is blinded. And at the same time, the meteors are spreading Triffid plant spores, which quickly come to life. Bill Mason, a merchant Navy officer, has been lying in a hospital overnight with his eyes bandaged, is unaffected, and leaves the next day. Then, while at a railway station, he comes across an orphan schoolgirl named Susan. She's also unaffected. It's also good to note that the world, or London at this time, is a sea of people who have gone blind. And they've got outreached hands. They're kind of walking around, groping, grasping at the air. So you can picture that scene. So anyways, Bill meets up with Susan and he helps her escape the desperate crowds, and they commandeer an abandoned car in order to reach his ship. On their way, the car gets stuck in some mud, and while they look for stones to gain traction, a Triffid, which is on the move, ambushes them and they barely escape. Meanwhile, scientist Tom Goodwin and his wife Karen have been isolated in a lighthouse and only learn of the emergency over the radio. Karen alerts Tom to a Triffid growing on a ledge, and they discover another inside the lighthouse. They discover that Triffids can apparently regenerate themselves, The couple then barricade themselves in and set to work to discover some means of neutralizing the plants.
After Mason and Susan finally make it to the dockyard, they only hear bad news over the radio. They then cross into France, where they come across a woman named Christine Durant. She guides them to a chateau that is serving as a refuge for the blind. While looking for supplies at a grocery store with Mr. Coker, who is Durant's servant, Mason discovers dozens of Triffids on the move. Later, the chateau, owned by Christine Durant, is invaded by escaped convicts, and during the mayhem of their invasion, Triffids move in and kill everyone except for Tom, Susan, and Christine, who escape on the prison bus. The trio then heads for the American naval base in Cadiz, and on their way they encounter a blind couple, Luis de la Vega and his pregnant wife, Teresa. The trio help them deliver a baby boy. Luis tells Mason that the Cadiz base has been evacuated by submarine. Mason gets De La Vega's radio transmitter working just in time to hear the Navy broadcasting a message about a final survivor pickup in Alicante the next day, along with a warning about wandering bands of Triffids.
The group decides to leave early in the morning, and Mason electrifies the fence around the villa as a precaution. When Triffids arrive, the current is too weak to hold them off, and Mason has to improvise a flamethrower from a fuel truck to subdue them. He also realizes that Triffids are attracted to sound, so he distracts them the next day with an ice cream truck playing music while the others escape. Mason manages to attract the attention of a naval dinghy, which picks him up and takes him to the submarine. Back at the lighthouse, the Triffids manage to break in while Tom and Karen retreat to the top of the stairs. In a last effort to hold them off, Tom sprays them with salt water, and the Triffids begin to dissolve in a cloud of green smoke. Tom realizes that seawater was the answer they'd been looking for all along.
A pretty neat and tidy ending where everything works out perfectly.
Oh, yeah. It's a classic like War of the Worlds ending where it was like this seemingly benign thing is suddenly the thing that actually destroys the extraterrestrial at the end.
Yeah. That sort of thing can be clever sometimes, but in this case, it's sort of like, we need a quick thing to destroy the Triffids.
Totally.
And they just landed on seawater.
Yeah. That absolutely reflects on the dysfunction of the screenwriting process on this film, which we'll get into. I think the plot is kind of all over the place, and I found it difficult to like keep track of what threat is most important at this time. I went into this thinking killer plant movie, and I actually got like a blind zombie movie.
Yeah.
The first half of the film, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I read a review of this movie. I think it was by DVD Savant, which is a pretty good website. They have a lot of good reviews on there. And they made the point that like, if most of the people in the world are blind, then like anything could be scary, basically, you know, like kittens or something could be like a source of this if nobody can see, which I think is kind of true of this movie too.
Right.
You're totally right about that.
I agree. Yeah. Lots. I mean, for such a seemingly, I don't know, maybe forgettable movie, there's a lot of names in it. We'll get into it. So the crew, the director is Steve Sakelli. This really is his best known work. He was a Hungarian director, emigrated to Britain before World War II. And that's kind of all I have to say about that. He did direct a movie called Hitler's Slave Girls. That's not right, but it's something like that.
Whoa.
40s.
I didn't see that one. I did see one called Lake Placid Serenade, and I thought that was a funny name for a movie, only because the movie Lake Placid is so funny. I don't see the Hitler one.
Let me see. Let's see some other titles. Revenge of the Zombies, Blonde Savage, Women in Bondage. There was a Hitler one. There was a Hitler one. It's okay. I'll find it.
Okay. Yeah, but I mean, like, The Day of the Triffids is like the only one of those movies that I've even heard of before. So he is not a very well-known director in any case.
Nah.
The producer is Philip Yordan. He was a writer for a long time in Hollywood. He made a lot of different kinds of movies in Hollywood. Epics like Anna Lucasta, gangster movies like Dillinger, westerns like The Man from Laramie by Anthony Mann, action movies by The Big Combo, which is fantastic. I love The Big Combo. I think he actually wrote those screenplays, but in some other cases, as a screenwriter, Yordan actually was a front for writers that were blacklisted, that were suspected of communist ties during the McCarthy era hearings. So Yordan would take the credit. He would be credited as screenwriter when in fact he was just a front for a blacklisted writer who actually did write the movie. But that's kind of neither here nor there. That's just an interesting backstory for him. He started his own company called Security Films. And yeah, that's the company that produced The Day of the Triffids.
Okay. Hey, I found out. Sorry.
No, it's good.
So women's slave, Hitler's slave women is not, that's a made up title. The movie I'm talking about is Women in Bondage. And it's from 1943. It's about the conditions for women under Hitler's regime. The plot involves two women in prison for speaking out against the government.
Okay. This sounds pretty good.
Yeah, sounds very different than Hitler's slave women.
Yeah, and very different from Day of the Triffids, for that matter, as well. Sorry, if I can return to Philip Yordan for a moment.
Yes, please.
I want to correct myself because I said that him being a front for blacklisted writers is kind of irrelevant in this case, but that's not true. That's actually exactly what happened. The writer of, or at least the initial writer of The Day of the Triffids, Bernard Gordon, was a blacklisted screenwriter. And Philip Yordan, who was the producer of the film, also took credit for writing the screenplay, which, I mean, we'll get into this in a moment, but he did do a lot of rewrites on the script. So it's at least a little bit like valid in this case.
Totally. Yep. And Bernard Gordon, he was familiar with his genre. The other big title that pops out looking at his filmography is Earth versus the Flying Saucers from the mid 1950s. That's a Ray Harryhausen special effects vehicle. So check it out for that. Do you want to talk about Ted Moore, James Bond fan?
Yes. Yeah. So Ted Moore was a cinematographer. He shot The Day of the Triffids. He was a South African British cinematographer. Like Vincent just mentioned, he worked on a lot of Bond films in the 1960s and 70s. Including From Russia with Love. He won a BAFTA for shooting that movie, which is one of the more beautiful Bond movies, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, worked on a lot of other movies as well. He won an Oscar and a BAFTA for A Man for All Seasons, which is another very good movie. Orca, he shot Orca, which we talked about recently.
No, what?
Yeah, indeed.
Really?
Yep.
That's not true.
It is indeed. I love, he was a co-cinematographer along with J. Barry Heron on the movie Orca.
Whoa.
Unexpected connection.
Sorry, that just blew my mind.
Yeah. It all comes together on Camp Kaiju.
Oh my God. Oh, that, I'll play the Troll 2 sound clip there.
We need to make that a recurring thing on the podcast for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ted Moore, you know, was a solid craftsman. He worked on a lot of different kinds of movies and generally did pretty good work.
That's great. Love that. So let's get into the cast briefly. So the lead male character in this film is Howard Keel. He plays Bill Mason. Very interesting. He was noted in the 50s for his like rich baritone voice, and he starred in a string of Western musicals from MGM. So think Seven Brides for Seven Brothers.
Annie, Get Your Gun.
Annie, Get Your Gun. That's what I was thinking of. Yeah. And he was just one of those like square jawed individuals. But later he found fame playing Clayton Farlow on Dallas for the entire run of that show. So good for Howard Keel. He had a career outside of the Triffids. So it's like, oh, you were in that one bad cult classic movie, apart from your like your truly impressive resume.
Yeah. And it sounds like he did not really enjoy working on this movie very much. But we'll get into that more in a moment.
Right, right. Nicole Murray as Christine Durant. She was a French actor known mostly again for Day of the Triffids. But this is interesting. I just had to throw this out there. She also played the love interest in a movie called Legend of the Incas, which apparently is like the source material for Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I just never knew there was a specific film that maybe Spielberg drew from.
Which I'm sure you want to see like so badly right now, right?
Immediately.
Yeah.
Charlton Heston plays this Tomb Raider character, essentially. And I'm like, what? Charlton Heston in essentially an Indiana Jones movie? Yes, please.
Yeah, I can see it being both awesome and offensive, but you know, that's that's all right. That happened.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah, I would love to see that too. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Also appearing in the cast of Day of the Triffids is Janina Fey, who plays young Susan. So she's a child actor in the movie. Although she was born in 1948, so she must have been like 13 or 14 when they shot this. Anyway, she was in a lot of Hammer horror movies around this time, like Dracula, The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll. She was in that movie as well. She was a stage actor, too. So, yeah, pretty decent child performance in this movie. Also in the film are Jeanette Scott, is Jeanette Scott as Karen Goodwin. Day of the Triffids is probably her best known work. She was also in a movie called The Devil's Disciple from 1959. Probably her most famous appearance, if you can call it that, or reference, I guess. She is in the Rocky Horror Picture Show song Science Fiction Double Feature. I can't recall the exact lyric offhand. Do you know what it is?
I get hot when I see Janet Scott fight off a Triffid. Something like that.
I'm impressed. I did not think you were going to know that. That's good.
I enjoy that movie and musical. And I know that song. It's full of references to like The Invisible Man, King Kong, Dr. X, which is like a great song for that. But I never caught the Triffids reference until this episode. And I was like, holy shit. Triffids are referenced in something I've been watching my whole life. So
that is cool. Wow. Yeah. Again, another unexpected connection. I like that movie a lot, too. I've never seen the stage musical, but I haven't seen it in a long time. So yeah, I'm due for a rewatch.
At least give that song a listen.
Yeah, for sure.
And then playing opposite her is an Irish actor named Kieran Moore as Tom Goodwin. All right. Production backstory and release. So as alluded to earlier, the movie is based on the 1951 science fiction novel The Day of the Triffids by John Wyndham. The only other title I recognize is The Midwich Cuckoos he wrote in the 50s, which was adapted into The Village of the Damned from 1960. A film long on my to-watch list.
I love it very, very much. It's one of my favorite British horror movies ever. I wasn't really expecting a lot when I saw Village of the Damned. And I don't tend to like creepy kid movies, which is like a big part of that movie. But it's fantastic. It's really creepy. It's beautiful. There's like some social commentary in it. So highly recommend it.
Nice. Sorry, Day of the Triffids, however, is a loose adaptation. So screenwriter Gordon and co-screenwriter, essentially, Jordan, they were kind of going back and forth with a lot of rewrites. There was some dysfunction. And even the actor Howard Keel reportedly hated his dialogue and improvised lines and like tried to like make it his own, which it's like, I don't know, as an actor, what do you do if you're given crap material? I don't know. Maybe you just stick with it, Troll 2 style, and then then you live on forever. But I don't know.
I don't know exactly how he tried to make it his own, but I don't think he really pulls that off in this movie. His role still seems like a pretty stock cliched action hero type thing, like very stoic and gruff and everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, apparently his attempt to make the role a little bit more unique did not work out, whatever he did.
He should have broken out into song and dance.
Yeah. Right. I mean, well, yeah, I was going to say something, but that would be getting ahead of ourselves again a little bit, which I have a tendency to do on the podcast. So
okay,
that probably would not have made the final cut, I would say.
All right.
You know, you mentioned that this was a very loose adaptation of the novel by John Wyndham. And I skimmed a little bit of the book. I didn't read very much of it, but I did just kind of do a little more research about changes between the book and the movie. So in the book, the Triffids were already on Earth before the meteor shower. And the reason that they were grown is because they have a very rare oil that was used in perfume. And they were like spread throughout the world because of basically like corporate espionage and like these spies for a perfume company like wanted to research or like steal the spores and then accidentally spread them. So anyway, the Triffids were already on Earth in the book, while in the movie they are included with the meteor shower that also blinds everybody. So that's a double whammy, I guess you could say. But, you know, probably the biggest change between the book and the movie is that the book ends a lot more ambiguously. Like, it's basically the group of characters who survive, or a group of characters that survives, ends up on an island, and they're just like, yep, hope we make it. Like, the Triffids are still out there, and, like, everybody's still blind for the most part. So, you know, again, like, that's, like, the connection to the birds, where it's sort of like an ominous, ambiguous ending where they temporarily make it, but their survival is not insured by any means, you know?
Yeah.
In the movie, of course, as we already talked about, there's the seawater, and that seems to solve the problem, and everybody lives happily ever after. So,
right.
Very much a big difference between the book and the movie.
And I had thought about the birds watching this movie. The movie, first and foremost, because they came out or were made the same year. But also that ending, that ambiguous ending, the doomsday scenario. It also reminded me of some Twilight Zone episodes from that era, which often seem to deal with the fallout of a nuclear war and what happens to humanity post apocalypse, essentially. And the whole they are not zombies in Day of the Triffids, but they act like zombies just because they're walking around with their arms outstretched, which also just made me think about zombie films from the 60s. So yeah, I don't know, I was a bit of a tangent, but it just made me think about a bunch of other things from this time period.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't really think about the like nuclear fallout, like post-apocalyptic vibe when related to Day of the Triffids, because like, I don't know, the movie seems so silly and like killer plants just didn't make me think of like atomic war or whatever. But I think it's a valid comparison because like, obviously that was on everybody's minds in the early 60s, you know, it was a very real threat, as we've talked about a lot on the podcast before. So I kind of like that connection, like, you know, maybe Day of the Triffids is like part of this like general anxiety about like, how would humanity survive if something apocalyptic were to happen?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't think about like the darker political like subtext of that, but I think it's there if you want to interpret that from it.
I agree. So we had dysfunction with the script. We had already we're deviating from the source material, and this is wild to me. The film wrapped production and they only had about 60 minutes of footage, and they were like, "That's too short. What are we gonna do? We need more movie."
Let's just tack a whole nother subplot onto it. Perfect.
I mean, it's like when you're forced to get creative, what do you do? So it's like, let's come up with a whole B plot about a lighthouse that's kind of playing isolation thing to two scientists. But they brought in a new director for this 30-minute subplot, Freddie Francis.
Yeah, he worked with David Lynch on The Elephant Man, Dune, and The Straight Story. The Straight Story is a stunningly beautiful movie, so highly recommend that. He shot a lot of other movies throughout his career as well. The Innocents by Jack Clayton, a very good, another British horror movie from the early 60s. The French Lieutenant's Woman with Meryl Streep, Martin Scorsese's Cape Fear. He won Oscars for shooting the movies Sons and Lovers, as well as Glory, the 1989 war movie with Matthew Broderick and Denzel Washington.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, a very, very accomplished cinematographer, had a long career. He was a director of some films as well, although, here they are. I don't really recognize most of the names. Oh, he actually directed the movie Trog, which is like,
oh,
I've never seen that one though either.
That's on my list to watch.
Yeah. I, you know, looking at the movies that he directed and not just was cinematographer on, it seems like it was kind of a lot of like B horror movies, like Trog, for example, The Creeping Flesh, Son of Dracula, The Ghoul, Legend of the Werewolf. So I think his directorial career was not as accomplished as his career as a cinematographer.
Hey, based on Triffids, that checks out.
Yeah, indeed. It does not really make me want to see more of his directorial movies.
No. Ironically.
Yeah.
The film Day of the Triffids was released in, I keep getting conflicting years here. So a lot of sources say 1963 and a lot of sources say 1962.
I noticed that as well. I'm going to try to get to the bottom of this. 1 second. Sorry.
That's all right. I'll keep talking. What is also crazy to me is it was actually hard to find sources about this movie. Doing my research, you know, I start with Wikipedia, sure, but I wanted to get deeper. I wanted to get, like, what's the actual production history? I had to check out several different blogs. I had to go to page 2 of my Google search, which never happens.
We're breaking our backs for this podcast.
I was like, page... oh, man. I'm playing detective here.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. It's surprisingly hard to find information about this movie. It's like everybody kind of forget. I mean, it has a cult following for sure. But like, just in terms of like ongoing conversation about this movie, it's hard to find anything online about it of like substantial, you know?
Yeah, which I feel like doesn't happen too often with the movies we review. I mean, they're still well-known movies.
Yeah. I do think 1963 is the correct release year. Like everything that I've seen says that it was released in the United Kingdom in April of 63.
Yeah.
So as far as I know, that's right.
Okay. Well, we're going to go 63 on the podcast. So come at us, Triffid fans, if you disagree with that.
Bring your primary sources. Prove us wrong.
There are other adaptations of this novel that I would like to watch, including most notably a 1981 BBC drama for television. And there it was announced in Variety this past year for another adaptation in the works. But we'll see what happens. I'm here for it. You know, I don't hate Day of the Triffids. I may be less of a fan of this movie, but I'm into the story if you know.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I still don't know why people keep on trying to make like Killer Plan movies. but maybe one day there will be a somewhat scary one and I'll be proven wrong. We'll see.
So you're just off Killer Plan movies in general. Whole genre.
I mean, they're just not scary. Like they could be funny. They could be interesting in other ways, like Little Shop of Horrors, for example. But yeah, Killer Plans can never be scary. That is my strong opinion. And I hope somebody someday can prove me wrong, but yeah, I'm sticking to it for the time being.
All right. Okay, everybody. Hey, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. And wouldn't you know, our mailbox is bursting. So we have a couple of comments I want to share. The first is from YouTube. This was a commenter, Kangaroo 7452, on our Troll 2 episode. Kangaroo commented, "Can we get Velosa Pastor? Do you know this movie?"
Yeah, I've heard about it. I would be happy to bring that to the podcast for sure. I think maybe we should have a couple episodes where we talk about good movies, but then we can go back to Velocipaster.
and yeah, I agree. So our commenter there is not the first one to bring up Velocipaster either. I've had, just talking to people, several requests. So hey, I think it's a strong contender for the show.
Cool. Let's do it.
But some good movies first.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely in the thick of our So Bad It's Good series right now. It's like, oh, there are good monster movies out there too, so let's watch some of those, you know.
Our second bit of mail tonight is from Jason Cornelis on Instagram. Jason writes, this was in response to the Troll 2 oh my god reel that I shared. He says, "If I were put in charge of a stage version, you would be the person I'd call to play Oh My God Guy." I know Jason personally, so I guess he's referring to me in our episode when I imitated that cry.
So yeah.
Thank you, Jason.
I could see that, yeah. But then you'd have to stand in that like flower pot for the rest of the show, the stage show. So, you know, if that's a sacrifice for art, if it gets to that, you know.
That's right. Well, thank you all for writing in. Those listening out there, please chime in, leave a review wherever you are consuming this podcast, and we'll get it on the show. So thank you for your support. Okay. Themes of the film. What do we got? First and foremost, post-apocalyptic societal decline. That's what I saw screaming out at me, sort of the fall of Western civilization or humanity in general. And how do people survive? How do social bands form? Which is certainly the strongest theme of the novel. Whether it is the strongest theme of the movie, I think is up for debate.
Yeah. I don't think it's the strongest theme in the movie. We'll get to what I think is the strongest theme in the movie in a moment, but it is there for sure. I think first of all, I just think it's funny how inept and like distraught everybody is as soon as they turn blind. Like, I understand it would be like very difficult to suddenly go blind. I'm not trying to downplay that, but there are numerous blind people in the world who function every day and like have fairly decent lives or whatever. Like, you know, I just think it's funny that like the world plunges into an apocalypse pretty much because everybody goes blind, and then like, you know, they turn into like raving maniacs and they're trying to like steal children and like everything's on fire and nothing works. It's like, this seems a little exaggerated, maybe, but maybe that's kind of a tangent.
No, I think that's fair for criticism. I mean, sorry to our blind friends and family members out there who don't get portrayed positively by this film.
No, definitely not. Yeah, like everything goes disastrously awry when everybody is turned blind. So one would hope if this were to happen in reality, that would not be true to life. But right. But who knows? Yeah, we'll probably never find out, I would imagine.
Probably.
yeah. But I don't want to say definitely. Like, there's not a 100% chance this will ever happen. So I do think it's kind of interesting. You know, you were talking about, like, how would humanity survive in a situation like this? And I think you were talking about how the book is very much about, like, people kind of like forming communal tribes and like helping each other out, which, you know, I just think it's kind of interesting with like the Blacklist background of the film and the screenwriter not being able to receive screenwriting credit because he was a, you know, rumored communist or whatever. And the book sounds like it was fairly socialist. Like, it was kind of saying like the best way to survive would be to pool our resources and like function as communes, basically. Mm-hmm. That's not really so much in the movie. Like, I think we see a little bit of that in the chalet that Christine Durant has, and like all the blind people that go there who are kind of like, they take refuge there and they're fed and they work together and things like that. But I mean, for the most part, the movie is still kind of like every man for himself. So it kind of reverts back to like the individualistic, capitalistic sort of one individual person is more important than the group or whatever. Yeah, so all that's kind of interesting context for this movie.
So that's very well said, Matt. Thank you. The other strong theme that jumped out at me was like the family, which reminded me of Gorgo. Do you remember Gorgo?
Yeah.
The two dad characters, essentially, and they adopt this child,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. I saw the same exact thing happen in this other British film from the early 60s. You have Bill Mason, and he links up with Susan, the child, and then they link up with Christine, the mother figure, and then they survive. They ride out this disaster as a unit. And the movie actually, and it ends with around a cathedral too. So there's, you know, tying in maybe traditional Christian values with the traditional family unit. There's a very, you know, I'll say conservative mindset there, but I don't conflate that with like modern Republican conservatism, right? It's just
right.
this is traditional. Maybe traditional is the more correct word, I think. But yeah, I think that's clear in this film.
Yeah, I agree. This, to me, is the strongest theme in the movie. I think we even kind of see that in the other subplot with the two husband and wife characters who are scientists who are like fighting with each other. And the man seems like a complete asshole. He's like a drunk and he's arguing with her all the time. And he doesn't care about his work anymore. And then it's like the Triffids who kind of like bring them back together and their work sort of like rekindles their love for each other. Like that, I think like the importance of family is also kind of suggested in that storyline as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And ice cream brings families together, saves families. Who doesn't love an ice cream truck?
Yeah. That actually is the number one theme in the movie for sure.
Get a Choco Taco.
That, yeah, instead of seawater, it should have been Choco Tacos that saved the day. They really, the screenwriters missed the boat on that one.
We could rewrite this.
You know, with like a killer plant movie, I feel like there's always the potential for like sort of like an eco-friendly or like, you know, humans are destroying the world sort of theme. But this movie doesn't really convey that very much.
Yeah. And it's interesting about the themes because I feel like these themes we're talking about are just baked into the source material and like the story itself. I don't know how intentionally the director like wanted to tease those out.
I was gonna say like the production was so chaotic, like I wonder if they were even thinking about themes, you know, like I think they were just kind of like rewriting it and like making stuff up on the spot and like didn't even know what movie they were gonna have until they were like, oh, we only have 60 minutes of footage, you know, like it's hard to imagine that like in the middle of all that they would be like carefully trying to elaborate on certain themes, you know.
Right. And it's and like, okay, so we have our traditional family unit. To me, it reads that just convention. Like, the writers are just like, yeah, we need a man, we need a woman. They come across this child. That they were just thinking about hitting the, checking off the boxes more than just purposefully intending a theme or a messaging.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. But I think that's interesting also because like it's almost like those themes just like seep into the movie because they're so prevalent in like movies and TV and books and every other kind of mass media. Like, you know, those themes are there even if like the artists didn't really even try to include them, you know?
What does that say about society at large then? What, you know, pop culture and how nature versus nurture, how are our values informed by things beyond our control?
Right. Yeah, that's one of the reasons I find mass media so fascinating, because like from the moment we're born, we're surrounded by these images and these lessons that we don't even know are being like hammered into our brains, basically. And like we can resist them. We're not just like brain dead consumers or zombies or whatever, but they're so ubiquitous. They're so like pervasive and they surround us all the time that, yeah, like we grow up and we live our lives thinking like family is the most important thing. And like, once upon a time, religion was the most important thing, and that's probably going away a little bit now. But like, yeah, those themes, you know, I mean, we learn them just by like being members of like a modern society, basically, you know, which is fascinating. It's like, it's both good and bad, I think, you know, or maybe, maybe those words don't even apply, but.
Right. It's just kind of something has to exist, some sort of, we have to live in some sort of environment shared by other humans. Otherwise, yeah, you just live in a vacuum.
Right. Yeah. And like a lot of that mass media can be great and artistic and creative. And like, you know, I love that stuff. But also there is the potential to be like, I don't want to say brainwashed, but to be like taught things that we don't really realize that we're being taught, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Subconsciousness. Okay. That was a very deep conversation that I enjoyed very much. So I'm glad we got onto that.
Can I add one thing real quick? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention this. Like, one of my favorite schools of thought or philosophy or whatever is the Frankfurt School in Germany, which kind of started arising in like the 20s and 30s. And then with like the rise of Hitler, a lot of those philosophers fled the country. Some of them were Jewish and they went to the United States or other countries. And they were very much writing about like, how could a country of seemingly decent, typical, normal people go along with this genocide, you know? And one of their theories was that like mass media was one of the ways that that happened through propaganda films, through, you know, books, newspapers, things like that. The Frankfurt School, like Walter Benjamin, Siegfried Krakauer, very much we're talking about how, you know, if you live in a modern society with mass media, you can be easily swayed without you even realizing it. And, you know, Nazi Germany is like the most extreme example of that. But it happens all the time still, I think, you know? So, yeah, I just wanted to shout out the Frankfurt School because it's so much fascinating stuff. And it kind of applies to this conversation.
It does. I just learned something. So that's important information to keep in mind in our sometimes too fast moving 21st century.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's talk about form and aesthetics, and then we can get to our breakdowns.
Sounds good.
Cool. What can I talk about? I didn't make any notes for this other than just like it was a poor quality print, right? It was shot in CinemaScope in color.
Sorry, it's Eastman color is like an outdated color processing thing, which I think was bigger in the United Kingdom than it was in the United States. So it does look a little bit more like faded than some other kinds of color processing.
Yeah.
I think even like, yeah, so you mentioned like the low quality print and it's like kind of hard to figure out what the aesthetic is if you can like barely even figure out what's going on. But then in like the slightly better versions that I watched just earlier today, like the cinematography is kind of overlit. Like there's not really very much contrast. It's kind of just like a flat wall of light, which generally is not very interesting. Like it's kind of just no shadows, no like, excuse me, no highlights or anything like that. There's also some kind of unconvincing composite cinematography. This is a technique that we've talked about in the past. It's where like numerous different planes of action are sort of like included in one shot. So you can have like background footage, for example, of like Tokyo in flames in the Godzilla movie. And then you can have like the guys in suits like fighting in the foreground or whatever. But in this movie, it is not convincing at all. You can definitely tell when like one like matte backdrop ends and like another begins. There are sort of like very stark lines between different planes of action. There's some really bizarre shots where like there are a bunch of like fires and explosions in one part of the frame. And then another part of the frame is just like, looks pretty normal. And like, people are just like standing there. It's not very well done or very convincing in the way that they combine those.
Yeah.
I guess the last thing we can talk about with the aesthetic is just the special effects on the Triffids, which I would argue are equally unconvincing. Maybe I'm going back to my plants are never scary diatribe, but in this case, they definitely are not. It's kind of a combination of men in Triffid suits for like some of the wide shots, especially the shot where like a ton of Triffids are like marching on the chateau towards the end. So those are men in suits. But then at other times you have like puppets of the Triffids and just like rubber mannequins that are being like pulled across the frame by wires.
Mm-hmm.
Whichever technique they use, it's not very convincing though. So generally, I mean, I would say not an extremely accomplished formal style in this movie.
Nope, I agree with you 100%. And it just makes me think, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but like, it's hard to make a movie.
Yeah.
Like Troll 2, you know, it's not a great movie, but it is competently made for the most part. I mean, compared to Triffids, you're like, oh my God, is it that difficult to do some of these effects, which I mean, it is.
Yeah, for sure. That's important to keep in mind. It's unfair to compare this movie to The Birds. I mean, Hitchcock is, you know, had all the resources at his disposal and the best craftsmen to work on that film. But like, you know, you mentioned that came out the same year as Triffids, and The Birds, for the most part, I think looks fantastic. It is scary. The bird effects generally are convincing. There are some like background shots that are not super convincing, but so yeah, I mean, it is difficult, but like this movie doesn't, I don't know if they didn't have the money or just the time or the care or whatever, but they are not able to pull it off in this movie.
Right. They struck out. So let's get to our breakdown.
I mean, I think we talked about a lot of it already. I'll just say, I guess there are some good individual moments in this movie. I do like the music, which is kind of like very brassy and like, you know, over the top, like a movie like this should be. The underlying story is strong. You kind of mentioned that before. So it leads to some kind of compelling moments, like when Mason wakes up in the hospital and the whole world has kind of fallen into catastrophe overnight. That's about all my good stuff.
That's all I got too. Like, great concept. Love the story, but that's about it. There's the plane when it's going down because the pilots are struck blind. I found that the one true like moment of tension in the film, but again, only because like that's inherently a stressful situation. You're up in the sky. Like everyone has a fear of crashing when they're in a plane. It's not effective because of the performances or the direction or anything like that. So even that can only go so far with me in holding my attention.
Yeah, I agree. Like, that's a compelling idea, but it's not really presented very well. Exactly. I would say, I guess I like the first maybe like 5 or 10 minutes in this movie. Like, I think the opening credits are fun. And then there's a scene of like a night watchman in like a botanical garden that's kind of atmospheric, I guess, but yep. it quickly goes downhill after that, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of the bad now, this is so that scene was good, but then like it immediately says like the world just accepts that Triffids are here and the deadly force. Like there's no build up, there's no sense of mystery. It's just like boom boom, Triffids are a thing. Great. But I thought we're all blind. I as the viewer don't know which is what this movie is. Like, what? Pick a thing, stick to it, okay? And my last big thing is that when everyone's blind, they act like they're in a stupor. Like, there's no emotion or acting involved. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, give me something. When the pilots are going down, there's no they're just like a Sunday stroll in the park. Like, what are they doing? What are they doing?
Yeah. I think you're totally right that they seem like zombies. Like some of them even, you know, just like have their arms out and they're stumbling around. Like that's not how people would behave if they were like suddenly like, yeah, struck blind overnight or whatever. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
I'd say bad acting, but the acting is non-existent.
Yeah.
I'm done.
But I do think it's bad acting. So, you know,
yeah.
I think maybe the actors are like inspired by the pretty bad script, which, you know, again, was in constant rewrites all the time. That leads to like a very sloppy story where, you know, there are all these extraneous characters like Bettina, one of the blind women who lives at the refuge. And then like the Spanish couple who, you know, the woman gives birth to her son. It's like, why is all this in the movie? Like, it's not related to the story. It doesn't really connect all that much to, you know, what the main characters are going through. Although I guess it does kind of present that nuclear family sort of theme. So anyway, the story's all over the place. It's poorly shot. And plants are not scary. I'll just end with that.
Good. So my campy is the poor dog that gets killed by a Triffid. And I'm like, not the dog. You killed the dog. But then, like, the way it's shot, the dog goes behind a bush. It squeals. It gets killed, right? And then there's just, like, a shot of the dead dog just laying out in the open. And it's a continuity problem. It's like a framing problem. Like, the dog just looks so cheesy just lying there. And it's supposed to be like a sad, tragic moment. But I'm like, the way this is executed, it's anything but sad and tragic.
Yeah. Kind of emblematic of like the lack of care and precision that they have throughout the entire movie.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say that there is also a dog that gets killed in the Toxic Avenger, which we'll talk about in our next episode. So beware of that. It's also not convincing, but it is like more shocking, I guess, than in this movie. So
okay.
Anyway, we'll get to that in the future.
Yeah.
For me, the campiest scene is in that plane scene that you were just talking about. When things are like kind of calm, like they're, you know, they're scared, they're blind, but they're like figuring it out. And then a kid is like, he asks the flight attendant, like, oh, is the pilot blind? And then like the rest of the passengers in the flight are like, blind? The pilot's blind? And like everything immediately like goes to shit. And it's like, did you all not figure that out yourselves? Like you had to, like this kid had to ask that for you to like realize the situation that you're in. And then of course everything goes to hell immediately. It's really funny and like, yeah, so ridiculous. I love
yeah,
that
it
part.
Seemed like a scene, like a cut, like a deleted scene out of Airplane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I thought too.
Yeah.
If only Leslie Nielsen had been on that airplane.
Oh, he would have saved the day then.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's great. I think that's about all we could say for this movie at this time.
Yeah, I agree. I did not expect to talk about the Frankfurt School when we began this episode. So that, you know, that's a success.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Bring us home.
All right. So as always, we have four rankings on Camp Kaiju. Number one, it's a timeless classic and definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but does not stand the test of time. And our lowest ranking, it's not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time. Should I go? Well, we just had a knowing look. I think I know what we're both going to say.
Let me just say that I had hoped that maybe our conversation would like bring me around to this movie and it would get bumped up. But I'm sorry to say, I don't think this movie has any fun moments. I don't think it's historically significant, and I don't think it stands the test of time. I think you could skip it and be okay.
Yeah, sadly, I would have to agree with that. Overall, it's not very fun and not historically significant, like you said. I didn't hate it. Like, you know, anytime you have like bad special effects in a campy sci-fi movie like that, you know, it's, I don't hate it, but yeah, it's not really worth revisiting. I'm going to have to give it the lowest ranking.
Right. Exactly. It's not out of hate for this film. It's just the film itself offers nothing worth my time.
Yeah. Right. I'm sort of curious to see the other versions, like the BBC miniseries, but
yeah.
I don't know. This movie doesn't make me extremely excited. It's like, is it going to be the same thing? If so, I can skip it, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. Don't hate us, Triffid fans. We love you. We appreciate you. But we also thank you for hanging out. And if you and everyone else liked what you heard, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit CampKaijuMovieReviews.com or Instagram for more monster movie content. We can't thank you enough. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with theme music by Terrence Jackson and Mina's Mailbox by Ben Cook-Feltz. Camp Kaiju is also sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in that bio.
G. Carroll was over a barrel when Tarantula took to the hills. And I really got hot when I saw Jeanette Scott fight a triffid that spits poison and kills. Dana Andrews said prunes, gave him the runes, and passing the muse lots of skills. But when worlds collide, said George Powell to his bride.